Good morning, I'm Michael Cathcart, and you're so very welcome to Books and Arts here on RN, where today you'll hear from the man who's probably the world's most famous living artist. He's the Chinese dissident Ai Weiwei, and he's in Melbourne for a big show of his work. And Munson and Lee, our mates from the ABC Sound Archives, are back with more astounding musical treasures on vinyl like this one. Listen to this. Oh, oompa. It's oompa music, it's called. We're also going to discover the difference between oompa music and oompa-pa music. I think this is oompa. Anyway, we'll find out later in the show. It's very nice to be with you this morning on RN for Books and Arts, where we start this morning with The Sympathiser, which is a gripping and masterly book. It's by Viet Tan Nguyen, and it opens with frightened people scrambling to evacuate Saigon as the city falls to communists in 1975. That's 40 years ago this year. Now, in the midst of all this shouting and tumult is a South Vietnamese army captain, and what the terrified people around him don't know is that he's actually a communist spy. Well, the writer, Viet Tan Nguyen, is an associate professor at the University of Southern California, where he teaches some really fascinating-looking courses, including one on war and memory. And this stunningly good book is his first novel. Viet, welcome.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me. It's a delight.
So good to have you here. So let's talk about your narrator. I guess we can call him the captain. He doesn't have a name. We'll call him the captain. He's an outsider, and he's the result of a liaison between a French priest and a teenage girl in rural Vietnam. And his divided self is really confirmed in the school playground. Can you tell us about that moment?
Well, you know, I was thinking a lot of the experiences of people of mixed race background in Vietnam, been colonized by France, and then the Americans had come, and you know, the French and the Americans had left a very substantial Eurasian and then Amerasian population. And everything I'd heard about their experiences of mixed-race children had been horrible. You know, the Vietnamese were racist and the Americans and the French weren't that much better. So a lot of what these children endured was, you know, on the streets and on the playgrounds where they were subjected to racist taunts and abuses. So a very formative moment for the captain as a young person is being told by his schoolmates that he doesn't fit in. He's neither one thing nor the other. He's monstrous, and it upsets him terribly, and it's a moment that, you know, scars him deeply, but it's also a moment that drives him to his first act of violence when he fights back against the schoolyard bully who's leading that taunting.
Yeah, and as a result of all this, he forms a bond with two other boys, which really is a bond that stays with him through his life.
Yeah, I was thinking very much about how for Vietnamese men in particular, the bonds of brotherhood, especially blood brotherhood, where you swear your allegiances to people who may not be part of your family, are very important. So the core of the story is that these three young men are in the Iron High School together in Vietnam, and they're all idealists. They all don't fit into conformist culture in various ways, and they swear allegiance to each other to defend each other against schoolyard bullies and the like. And then history takes its course, and they end up on different sides, although they don't all know it. Our narrator, the captain, and one of his blood brothers, Man, secretly swear to be communists, while their other blood brother, Bon, stays true to the South Vietnamese or Republican cause. And he, of course, doesn't know that his two other blood brothers have basically become traitors to his own cause. And it's these underlying tensions between blood brothers who are betraying each other or who are secretly opposed to each other that drives a lot of the drama in the book.
It certainly does. Before we go on to explore the story, do you mind if we talk a little about you and learn, you know, where you're coming from as the teller of this tale? Because you were born in Vietnam. How did you get to the USA in 1975?
Well, I had one of those very dramatic escape stories, which, you know, is not very dramatic when you compare it to a lot of other Vietnamese refugees. Basically, everybody I know who's a Vietnamese refugee who made it out of the country, whether it's 1975 or through the late 70s and 80s, had horrifying stories, and ours is relatively tame. We were living in a small town called Ban My Thuot, which is in the Central Highlands, and it's famous for coffee, but also for being the first town overrun in March 1975 at the beginning of the communist invasion, and the town was cut off from communication, which was bad because my father was actually in Saigon on business, left my mother, my adopted sister, my older brother, and myself. And my mother made a life and death decision that she was going to flee that town, take my brother and myself, but leave my adopted sister behind to take care of the family property because she thought we were coming back. You know, the war had seesawed back and forth, and she didn't think the war was really going to be done, which of course it was. So I didn't see my adopted sister again for nearly 30 years. My mother walked downhill a few hundred kilometers with myself and my brother through apparently a really horrifying landscape of refugees and dead soldiers, made it to Nha Trang, We caught a boat to Saigon, found my father, and a month later we had to flee again on another boat when Saigon was taken by the communists, and that's how we got to the United States.
So you were four. Do you remember this?
I don't remember. I mean, I have some flashes of memory, but I have no idea if they're reliable. I told my brother, I remember we were on a boat and the sailors were shooting at another little boat. And he said, no, that didn't happen. So he could be right. I could be right. But really, the beginning of my narrative memory happened when I got to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, which was where we were resettled. And I was 4 years old and I was separated from my parents. To leave the refugee camp, all the Vietnamese refugees had to have sponsors, but there was no one willing to take all four of us. So my parents went to one sponsor, my brother went to one sponsor, and I went to another. And for me, that was, you know, at 4 years old, really traumatic. And that's an experience that I think really shaped me.
Well, after the thriller-style opening, I did think, oh, no, the book's going to be a terrible anticlimax. We're going to get to the safety of the USA and all this excitement's going to stop. But actually, the moral dilemmas become deeper there because the captain is surrounded by people for whom, as you say, the war has not ended.
Well, I think, you know, for most of the world, when they think about the Vietnam War, they think about April 1975, the fall or the liberation of Saigon, these images that were circulated all over the world, and that's what the first 50 pages refers to. And then everybody stops thinking about Vietnam and what happened to the Vietnamese people, either in Vietnam or the ones who fled the country. And so in the novel, I really did want to delve into the fact that this was not only a war that was for other people and the spectacles of Hollywood and TV and all of that, but for the Vietnamese people of all sides, the war continued informally. And for the Vietnamese who had fought with the Americans and who had fled then to the United States and to Australia and to France and so on, they carried those political divisions and hatreds and passions with them. And wherever they settled, they continued to be deeply attached to that past, and oftentimes either to continue fighting the war with the Vietnamese in Vietnam or fighting with each other in the new places they found themselves in. And that's the kind of, you know, drama that the middle part of the novel deals with.
I live in Melbourne in the south of Australia, and there's a big Vietnamese community here. And I can remember in the 70s, it was widely said that the Vietnamese community, who of course were from the south, they're the people who had to flee, that they were kind of regrouping to reinvade Vietnam. And I just imagined that was just gossip. But you're saying it really is plausible that people were thinking about how they could retake their country.
Oh, it was very plausible. And when I was growing up in the 1980s, I would go to the community celebrations for Tet, the new year, and I would see exhibitions showing pictures of guys in jungle camouflage living in the Thai jungle, training themselves to counter-invade or take back the homeland. And the purpose of that was to raise money for them. And there were rumors that the very first international pho chain, the beef noodle soup thing that people all over the world love. It was started, you know, to fund this revolution or this effort to take the country back.
Heaven, so I've poured thousands of dollars into the revolutionary cause, it turns out, eating soup.
Yeah, and you didn't know that, you know, part of it was funding the revolution, right?
Yeah.
But so, I mean, how much of it was really true, how much of it was false is really debatable. I mean, there's not much research on it, but really there was that movement. There really were guys in Thailand. They really did try to invade through Laos, and they met a terrible end in Laos. How large they were, no one really knows for sure. I mean, the people who did it say there were thousands, and other people say there were hundreds, and in the end, it all just fell apart in the 1980s.
On RN, this is Books and Arts with Michael Cathcart, and my guest this morning is the American scholar and author Viet Tan Nguyen, and we're talking about his dark and sometimes funny debut novel, The Sympathizer, which I just think is marvellous. If you're looking for a book to read this summer, this really is one to put on your list. So the captain, we were talking about the captain, he's our central character, he has to maintain his cover once he gets back to America, which means that in this peacetime country, he ends up having to assassinate a poor harmless man who used to be a major in the South Vietnamese army. And that's a shocking moment. What can we say about that, just to give the sense of a listener of what's entailed in that?
Well, our narrator, our captain, has gone deep. You know, he's deep undercover. He has to do whatever he can to maintain that cover while he also tries to subvert the South Vietnamese that he's spying on. And so when his boss, the general, who's a paranoid man, sees a communist spy in this innocent major and orders our captain to kill him, the captain can't figure a way out of that dilemma. And so he has to make a choice between two situations. You know, one, he can either kill the captain and maintain the cover, or he cannot kill the captain and basically lose the general's trust and not be able to fulfill his job. So he does what he thinks he has to do. And partially based on real-life events, you know, there were these kinds of assassinations happening in the United States that were never solved. And but more to the point, it gets to the big question of the novel. What is to be done? Our narrator, our captain, is confronted by that question. He confronts himself with that question on a regular basis. He believes in history. He believes in revolution. He believes in action. And unfortunately, you know, anybody who is a person of action who does what has to be done has to deal with the moral consequences that oftentimes it can be not just unsavory, but immoral, contradictory, deeply problematic. And that's the quagmire of history that anybody who believes they can change history finds themselves in, and as our captain does.
So is this book partly a caution against the danger of revolution?
Well, in some senses, yes, because, you know, obviously the Vietnamese Revolution was successful in its short-term goals of achieving liberation and independence, and it was in the 60s and 70s really a global inspiration for revolutionaries all over the world, from Asia to Africa to Latin America. But yet what happened in the 1980s and onwards was that the revolution basically failed. It betrayed its ideals. Now you have a Vietnam that's communist in name but capitalist in practice. And, you know, the government is deeply cynical. The people are cynical. It's a real tragedy about what can happen to a revolution. But at the same time, you know, the book, it ends on a somewhat optimistic note that even if this revolution fails, the ideals and the possibilities of revolution still exist if we learn from our mistakes.
One of the paradoxes of America, it seems to me, looking at America from the outside, is that you have this bedrock of conservatism underlying so much of American politics, not entirely, but the conservative side of politics is robust. And that side also believes in revolution. They believe that they were born out of revolution, and often their foreign policy seems to be shaped by the belief that if you can trigger a revolution in another country, it will be of a democratic American kind, whereas the rest of the world tends to think of revolutions as leading to sort of, you know, communism or Marxist outcomes. Conservative Americans often think that a revolution will produce people who want to go to Walmart.
Well, I think there is a part of the book which is quite, you know, cognizant of these contradictory tendencies in American culture and history, and it's satirical of these tendencies. I mean, certainly the book refers to how there was an American Revolution that was actually fairly radical a couple of centuries ago. But as is typically the case, you know, revolutions calcify, they harden, they become conservative, and that's what's happened to the United States. And so the conservative right-wing movement in the United States sees itself as the inheritor of this revolution for freedom. But of course, I think from my perspective, you know, that it's a perversion of what freedom means. And it's really an endorsement of American state practices, American global domination, that is the mirror image of what the American Revolution actually meant in terms of independence for a small country in 1776.
Viet, one of the highlights of the novel is a long episode in which the captain goes off to the Philippines to work as a cultural advisor on a movie about the Vietnam War. Can we just talk briefly about real movies? Because, you know, I'm interested to know what happened when you were younger and you saw movies like Platoon or Rambo. What was your identity when you watched them? Did you watch them as a little American, or did you see your Vietnamese self there being sort of blown up?
Well, both, I think. Like everybody else who grows up in the United States, I am deeply enamored of American popular culture, saw all kinds of war movies, you know, identified with American soldiers and World War II movies and so on. And then the Vietnam War movies, you know, came, and I was watching them at the same time. And of course, I was identifying with American soldiers because it's through their eyes that these stories are told. And then, as you imply, once they start killing Vietnamese people, it was an awful moment of being split within for me, of recognizing that for everyone else who was watching these movies, I wasn't the American. I was the gook or the Vietnamese being shot or killed or just relegated to the sidelines with nothing to say or having only literally gobbledygook to say. So that scarred me pretty deeply, those movies that you talk about, and Apocalypse Now, which is referenced in a significant way in the Philippines section.
Now, Apocalypse Now is a very different kind of movie, though. Those other ones, you know, they've got a sense of the darkness of war, I suppose, but in the end, they're Trumpful movies, whereas Apocalypse Now is about a very disturbing view of war and what America has become in the face of war. How did you respond when you saw that?
Well, you know, the satire in the book refers to all these different kinds of movies, but I think the reason why Apocalypse Now seems so much more foregrounded is precisely because of what you're saying, that it's actually an intelligent movie. It's a movie about the heart of darkness. But if you know anything about Apocalypse Now, it's also about the making of it, Francis Ford Coppola and so on. It's also a movie about megalomania in its making, you know, both in its depiction of Kurtz and Marlon Brando, but also Francis Ford Coppola itself. And the irony is that for all of the artistic genius that goes into making this movie, which I respect very much, at the same time, it also completely subordinates, erases, marginalizes Vietnamese people. And so as someone who really respects that movie as a work of art. I'm also deeply antagonized by it in terms of what it does to Vietnamese people. So this is my revenge.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's sweet revenge. It's sweet revenge.
Yeah, I hope. Yeah.
And although you say you've drawn on all sorts of movies, I mean, Apocalypse Now is front and center because, as you say, you've got this egocentric director just called the auteur. And we do think of Francis Ford Coppola. And the Marlon Brando character in this play is just this actor. And there's a reference to his final death scene. This is what Brando actually says in his famous final death scene.
The horror. The horror.
There he is saying, the horror, the horror. But in fact, you have him say,
the whore, the whore. You know, and partially it's because I myself can never really pronounce the difference between those two words, right? And so there is a part of the plot where he is killed by a prostitute, and those are his final words.
I laughed out loud when I read the whore, the whore. Now, elsewhere you've talked about something you call ethical memory. Can you tell us what you mean by that? Because it seems to play into what your overall project is here.
Yeah, well, I'm a scholar as well, and I've been thinking about issues of war and memory for 13 years, writing this book that's coming out in March from Harvard called Nothing Ever Dies, Vietnam and the Memory of War. And ethical memory is what I work on there. And basically the issue there, what I'm arguing for is that, you know, ethical memory is challenging. It's hard. It's much easier to be unethical in our memories. It's much easier to just remember people that we consider to be part of our own group, whatever that means. And certainly growing up in the United States and encountering all these American memories, I thought these memories were unethical because the American ethnocentric will to just remember themselves is what led the U.S. into Vietnam, what led them to conduct this horrible war, and what's led them to not remember the lessons of the Vietnam War and fight the current wars in the Middle East. And so ethical memory is important for these political reasons, to remember others, to remember people we would rather overlook. But it's also important for art, for writing. It's crucial for the work of the artist or the writer or the filmmaker to have an ethical memory, to be cognizant of what it means to talk about and to tell stories about others.
The other idea that's had a lot of currency on our show here at Books and Arts this year is W.G. Siebel's idea of inherited trauma. And I gather that this is an idea that's also appealed to you. Can you explain the idea?
Yeah, I think the word that he uses, maybe he also used inherited trauma, but he also said secondhand memories. And I thought that was really powerful. You know, he was born during World War II, had no memory of the war, but, you know, spent his entire career writing about the Holocaust and Germans during World War II. And certainly, I think that's a very universal experience for anybody whose parents have been shaped by war and trauma, as mine have. So even though I have no living memory of Vietnam or the war, I feel that I've inherited some set of memories and some set of feelings from my parents and what they endured. Those things shaped their lives, shaped what they said and didn't say, you know, all kinds of behaviors. And that was part of the environment that I grew up in, and it shaped me too. And that's why I think a lot of people, the second generation after a war, find themselves continuing to be shaped by things that preceded their own memory.
Yeah, well, it's a powerful idea. Viet, it's been lovely to meet you, and congratulations on this book. It's an absolute triumph, and I recommend it wholeheartedly.
Thanks so much, Michael.
Viet Thanh Nguyen, he's an associate professor at the University of Southern California, and his debut novel is called The Sympathizer. It's published in Australia by Allen & Unwin. And yeah, I reckon you'll hear a lot more about this book. In my mind, it's one of the standout novels of the year. On RN, this is Books and Arts with Michael Cathcart. Still to come, we hear from the great Chinese artist Ai Weiwei. He's in Australia for a major retrospective of his work. But now it's time to don your Lederhosen or slip into your dirndl. Yes, we're journeying beyond the vinyl frontier to listen to a type of music perfected by the bands of Bavaria. And apparently it's called Umpa music. I mean, I suppose a good name for it. Here we go. Listen to the Umpa. Well, that's not Umpa. Here's one. Our ABC sound librarians are James Lee and Michael Munson.
Good
in
morning.
Their Lederhosen.
Uh-huh.
What splendid legs you've both got. I had no idea.
Danke.
You're very welcome. So who's this? What is this?
This is Will Glauer and his orchestra, and this is the Kuckelwalzer, which is the cuckoo dance.
Hence the cuckoo.
That's
one can
it.
Hear the musical cuckoo reference.
Yeah. Yes.
It's a beautiful thing, isn't it? Two key ingredients here, the tuba and the accordion. basically are the crucial ingredients that goes to make
There are three. There's that little instrument that's going cooking. What on earth is that?
Yeah, that's true. But more broadly speaking, though, this is from an album called Strictly Oompa.
Right.
And this is a classic. A lot of our listeners out there will be aware of this one. And this is released on the Decca label. A beautiful recording, as Michael said, by Will Glahr and his orchestra. Should we just keep listening? It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, it's lovely. A nice swell, as if we're going to do something different, but go back to where we were.
Drop back into that cuckoo.
All right.
Yes, the cuckoo.
In Australia, you don't hear too much oompa, and especially not on the radio.
No.
So, but we were looking at our collection the other day, and we just found hundreds of oompa records.
Maybe there's some hard questions to be answered by who was doing the buying back then, because there was no demand for the records you've got in the library.
They've been played.
Have they?
Yeah, they all look,
well-loved.
Well-loved, and in the 60s and 70s, that must have been played.
Oh, there's absolutely no doubt that oompa was a massive thing. Back, I'm looking at, say, the 60s, which is where a lot of the LPs that we're about to play are from.
But the idea that there is a genre called oompa, is this something you've cooked up in the library? This is a term.
No, this is a genuine musical form. Now, the term oompa, basically, as you would guess, derives from the sound of the on and off beat that we heard beautifully there. The tuba is usually the on, and then the
downbeat.
The upbeat is usually an accordion or a clarinet or something like that, right? Yeah.
So they're in a polka form or a waltz,
a 2-4.
Yeah, or a 3-4 time.
Yep.
So you have a 1-2-3 oompa pa.
Yeah. That's oompa pa.
Yeah.
Yeah. And oompa is just a 2-4.
That's it.
We're making a fine distinction between your oompa music and your oompa pa music.
Yes. Yes. Now, we have to establish those
grounds. There's a difference in, 2-4 for marching, 3-4 for dancing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So, but look, it's a, if you're in Germany tonight, you could hear this. This is played everywhere.
I've heard music like this in Germany. In Berlin, I heard music like this. I think it was in Berlin or Munich or something. Famous beer hall that I won't name. And, there was a band in the middle playing this.
But it's about fun and it's festive music.
It is festive.
It's about dancing and drinking. Yeah. And this is the right time of the year to be
playing
this stuff.
Absolutely.
We've got another one, or you've bought another one, and this one features a kangaroo.
It does. I don't know if there are kangaroos in Austria.
Kangaroo for nach Tirol.
Tirol? Now, and where's Tirol?
It's in Austria.
It's in Austria.
And I think I couldn't find this song anywhere, translation or lyrics.
Yeah, so we're a bit unsure exactly what's going on here lyrically, but it is obvious that the singer is talking about kangaroos.
It means a kangaroo went to Tyrol.
That's right.
So the Tyrol is the mountainous area between Germany and Italy.
Exactly.
So they're hopping around in the mountains, these kangaroos. Yeah.
And I think it's to do with the language of the difference between Australia and Austria.
You think
people confusing the two.
Oh, it's that old joke.
That's my...
Let's go with that theory.
Yeah.
Let's go with that.
Let's hear this.
Ein Känguru, das fühlte sich nicht wohl. Drum sagt es eines Tags, juhu, ich fahre nach Tirol.
Im heißen Land Australien, da fühlt es sich nicht wohl.
Und via Norditalien fuhr's einfach nach Tirol. Ein Känguru fuhr einmal nach Tirol.
Nanu,
Nanu,
Nanu.
I think this is fantastic.
Isn't it great?
I'm cursing the fact
brilliant?
That I didn't pay attention in my German lessons at school, because it's very clear. There'll be people listening who know exactly what they're saying.
But it's basically, as Michael suggests, I think, or as I think you said, somehow a kangaroo goes to Austria, or as far as I know, they're not. Would you ever see a kangaroo in Austria, Michael? I can't imagine that you would. You might see photos of one.
But when you go to... when you go to Austria, there are people with T-shirts that say there are no kangaroos in Austria because there, there are people who show up in Austria thinking maybe
I think that's an oldie.
Yeah. There's an Australia-Austria thing. That's quite clever.
Yeah. I think I said the Tyrol's between Germany and Italy. It's between Austria and Italy. It's that sort of region there.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's a good one.
That's a ripper. We couldn't resist that because of its beautiful Australian connection.
I think we should re-release it.
Yeah.
And translate it.
We should. Maybe one of the listeners would.
Send us in a translation if you're out there. Yeah. I mean, you could find it on the internet, I'm sure. And we'll send you the audio if you.
If anyone wants to volunteer, we'd be quite happy to enlist their services.
Why don't we go the whole hog and see if we can record it?
The three of us.
Wow. Yeah. Really? Okay. Sure.
We could find
and,
some
and
music.
In fact, if we do get an English translation, an Australian version of it would be great, wouldn't it?
We've thrown down the challenge to ourselves.
Yeah.
This is Beyond the Vinyl Frontier, and we do this from time to time. James Lee and Michael Munson, who work in the Sound Library, they help us every day, you know. All those lovely bits of music that ornament our program, they find them for us usually.
That's true. Mm.
That's what you do. But in order to stay sane,
they
rummage around in the enormous record collection that they look after here. Huge number of LPs. Mm.
Yeah.
And today we're looking at Oompah and Oompah Pa music. All right. Oh, this one's Oompah Pa.
It is.
And also a polka, isn't it, Michael?
It's a polka and it's a machine.
It's a mechanical polka.
How do you mean?
Produced by something called the Fantastic Jazz Orchestra. So this is a machine we're going to listen to here.
Hand me the record so I can see the picture.
So this would be made available in many of the kind of German music halls that you referred to earlier. And you would put some money in it and you would bring up whatever your favourite kind of polka was. Or something else.
So this is like a mechanical jukebox, but it's got there's an accordion in the middle, there's a drum, there's a snare drum, there are cymbals.
Yeah, it's an orchestrata, is it?
Orchestrion.
Orchestrion, that's it. Yeah.
Okay. Here, let's have a listen.
Let's listen. This is mad.
Oh, yes, it sounds like an orchestrion, now that you say.
Yeah.
Here we go.
Here it goes.
If you're wondering what this song is called, it means that it translates as "You can't be true, dear."
Yeah.
Yes.
Which was a popular hit at some point, and I believe it's a variation.
It doesn't sound like a grief-stricken song, does it?
No, it doesn't. No, it sounds like an enormous amount of fun.
Someone's awfully happy about that.
I think this is a mashup, though, isn't it, of polkas?
I think. Well, it says medley.
It's a medley of.
That's quite plausible. Yeah.
Let's move on to Harry Werner.
Yeah, because we were talking about dancing before, and Oompah is basically, particularly as you say, when it's Oompah Pa, 3/4, folk music. And so we've got an album here that sort of gives us an idea of what a kind of very typical German, Austrian, Bavarian folk festival would sound like. So
and the scene, setting the scene.
And setting the scene for what you might walk into if you walked into a village square and in a little Bavarian village.
Well, and there's thigh slapping going on here.
And now what do we call it, Michael?
There's whooping going on.
Schuhplattler.
And so that's the dance, the very well-known dance where you'll see lots of hopping around and slappings of the thigh and the soles of the feet. Yes, the shul is the soul, platter is flat.
And involves some beer.
Lots of beer, lots of lederhosen.
You might hear this.
Yeah. You'd hear lots of whooping and slapping. Let's have a listen.
Oh, they're having a good time.
having a great time,
all that
aren't they?
Thigh slapping and shoe slapping. Shoe, I think, not sole. I think shoe was shoe.
So this is a classic Oompa band setup.
Now, after
you've got the tuba or sousaphone, which is a you know, a wraparound instrument that sits around the body, so
the
they can walk around. It's a big curly one.
Very heavy.
You've got the euphonium. You've got some trombone, I think,
and lots of steins of lager.
Lots of lager.
Yeah.
So drinking beer.
Drinking beer is a common theme too that runs throughout Oompa, isn't it?
It is.
It seems the two are kind of synonymous: drinking beer and listening to Oompa.
But all this deep bass, you know, it just reminds me of techno, or you know, involves partying and you know.
Absolutely.
There is something about the bass that gets you moving.
Yeah, for sure.
And makes people happy.
Yep.
Yeah. So you think it's the techno of the Tyrol?
I do.
It's a nice phrase. Let's
techno
go
of the Tyrol.
Techno of the Tyrol.
Or something like maybe house or something.
Yeah.
But, gets you up on your feet.
Yeah, well, that's the idea. It's Volksmusik, as they say, the people's music. So, yeah, it's inextricably linked to lots of festive folk occasions.
And you've got a drinking song?
We've got a drinking
song. Well, of course
we have. A drinking song with Franz Hotzmann.
Mm, and his orchestra.
And his little orchestra.
Let's have a listen to
this
drinking song.
This is a classy number.
Cheers.
I like this. It sounds tipsy, doesn't it?
It does. It's a bit woozy, isn't it?
It's a bit woozy.
It's good. I wish we had some words. I want to sing along.
We could make something up.
We could, yeah. But that's a classic, yeah, the drinking song. It's got that woozy kind of edge to it, hasn't it? Mm. You know?
Well, we're getting to that
that stage of the night, aren't we?
Yeah.
Where things are getting a bit woozy. Now there's that accordion there again, isn't it? You know, like it's constant, you know, throughout the...
I can see myself coming back in another life and being the accordion player in a band like this.
Yeah, it'd be great fun.
It'd be enormous fun.
Oh, I'd love it.
We all would.
Yeah, I'd love to see that.
What's your final song?
It's Hutzblau, Morgenblau, which is New Morning or Today and Tomorrow.
Today morning, tomorrow morning.
Yeah.
And again, this is an ambient kind of piece, isn't
this
it?
This is.
Recorded at one of those halls that Michael was saying.
Music hall in Hamburg.
Yeah.
And it's an anonymous group of people enjoying themselves.
Celebrants,
right.
And you can hear the time... signatures kind of slipping a little bit here, but
that's good.
It's good. I really enjoyed this.
Being blue, today blue, tomorrow blue. Flowers blue.
Oh. Yeah. Right, okay. They don't sound blue.
No. It's the Oompa that does it.
I know. Yeah.
You know, when I go overseas and you get together with people from all over the world and someone says, why don't you play us a tune from your country? And, you know, people have music like this.
Mm.
And I always feel the lack of that. I think, what am I supposed to do?
Yeah.
I don't know. Am I going to sing?
I discovered that
in
Germany. I was at a party and people were linking arms, singing songs all night. And there was an international crew there and they were asking everyone to... sing something.
Yeah.
And I really couldn't offer much. And all of them started singing Kookaburra and Sits Around the Gum Tree.
Oh, and you mustn't do that to get into legal trouble.
Yeah.
Yes, right. But they knew, they all knew it off by heart. It was interesting and feeling a little bit...
Something to reflect on. Well, thank you very much for coming in and clearing up the distinction between oompa and oompa-pa.
Yes.
Different kinds of music, but closely related.
Very.
If you could master one, you could probably get your head around it.
Yeah, that's
our sound librarians are James Lee and Michael Munson. They look after us so beautifully every day of the week, and sometimes they come in and share their knowledge with you and share some of the treasures they look after there as we go beyond the vinyl frontier. I'm Michael Cathcart. This is Books and Arts. Next up, Ai Weiwei.
The Minefield.
2015's been quite a year for you, Waleed, winning some Walkleys, a few viral videos, you've generally conquered the public sphere, and yet I dare say that your greatest triumph of this year is you got me to use a sporting metaphor.
And you did it correctly, but can you name the sport that you used as the metaphor? See, this is the problem. We have work to do.
Waleed Ali and Scott Stevens. The Minefield. This morning, 11:30, here on RN.
Now, this week, the National Gallery of Victoria unveils its big summer exhibition, which features two of the very big names of the 20th century, the American pop artist Andy Warhol, who died in 1987, and the Chinese polymath and dissident artist Ai Weiwei. And the show places the works of these two artists alongside each other, and all sorts of parallels and differences emerge from this juxtaposition. There are over 300 works in this, and some of them are newly commissioned from Ai Weiwei, including an installation that's made... This is amazing. It's made from over 1,500 bicycles. He loves making things out of bicycles. This is part of a series he does called Forever Bicycles. 1,500 of them in the new show at the National Gallery of Victoria. So to launch this exhibition, Ai Weiwei is actually visiting Melbourne. And on Monday evening, Virginia Trioli from ABC Television's Breakfast Show spoke with the artist at a public event at the gallery. Here's a taste of what they said.
I want to ask when art... When you realised art had an important part in your life, when did you start to see this as a medium that spoke to you and perhaps a form of expression that would become your life? What's your earliest memory of that?
I never really want to become an artist, but till very late, I think art is a place I can escape because everywhere is politics, so it's very hardcore politics to remember all the Chairman Mao's slogans, all the party's lines. So art has its own logic or own reasoning. So that's what I want to find, a place to hide myself.
Well, you studied at the Beijing Film Academy, and you studied animation there, and you became involved in the Stars group of avant-garde artists, and that was a very important part of your early artistic life. But it seemed you were seeking something else, because you went to the United States and you went to New York, and those more than 10 years there seemed to be very, very crucial. Do you know what you were looking for at that stage? Why did you want to go there, and why spend so long there?
I become an artist because I want to escape the politics in China, and I see it's very crude and very dangerous even to stay in China then. I see people we know get into prison, and only because they are young and they start to think about the future of China. So I told myself I have to escape, and so I went to the United States, and of course went to New York. The reason I went there is America or New York is like the most hated by communists. I think that must be the farthest place I can go. I told myself I will never go back. You know, later I made a mistake. I really went back, and that's how I spent 12 years in United States, 10 years in New York, and by then I got to know an artist like Duchamp, Jasper Johns, Andy Warhol, you know, and all conceptual art and the whole American traditions.
Indeed, yeah. And that's where it seems your conceptual practice really, really took root and came together. But the photography never left you. You were photographing the entire time you were there. And photography is an imagery making of that kind, and filmmaking is central to the work that you do. Why do you love photography and why do you love film work so much?
First, in New York, I rented many apartments, but each of them are very small.
Yes.
So you cannot really work on painting because I paint very fast. So it takes a few days, I would fill up the whole apartment. And so it's not a very economic way to... But you still need something in your hands, so a camera would be... next thing to do.
At that time, you produced one of your most significant works, which is actually here on exhibition in the show, which you'll finally get to see when it opens a little later in the week, which, of course, is Safe Sex, which is the raincoat and the condom produced at the apex of the AIDS crisis around the world, but particularly in New York. Was the AIDS crisis a big part of your life? Was it affecting you and people that you knew at that time?
In the 80s in New York, it's a big part of everybody's life. You know, everybody got scared because nobody knows how, and people just feel very insecure. Suddenly something which can come from such an intimate contact, you know. So everybody got scared, and you know, in the 60s it's about... you know, rock and roll or drugs or sex, but suddenly you heard about this AIDS situation. But at the same time, people are kind of shy away from it. You know, not people doesn't really mention it. Like today, you can say AIDS very openly. So it's still a little bit a secret at the beginning, but it's very scary.
One writer recently noted that as the years go on for you, the line between your art and your life has become indistinguishable. When did you become aware, when were you conscious that activism had become a major part of your art project, that activism and art were coming together for you?
And I only become fully aware when my head has been put a black hood driving to a secret place. Now, I got some kind of warning before, and like my friend Uli Sik told me, said, wait, you know, be careful, people start calling you activist. I laughed about it.
You laughed about it because you didn't think you were an activist?
Because I don't care what people calling me. And till I have been put handcuffed, then I have to be careful because if I have to go to the bathroom, I have to ask them their permission. Mm. So, you know, it's otherwise I still wouldn't care people, they call me this or that, you know.
Michael Sheridan of The Times suggested that you offered yourself to the authorities on a platter with some of your provocative art. Do you think you were being overly provocative of the authorities?
I don't really think so. I'm an artist, you know. My platform is really very small, you know. If you have states controls every resource, if you have a party, you have 80 million members, you have millions of policemen, and you know, I'm just one clown, you know, a funny artist who... Yeah, who cares? I thought that way. I always wrong, so, you know.
That all changed, of course, in 2011, when you were arrested and jailed for 3 months. Did that time in jail change you?
It didn't change me in principle, but it does change me on my behaving. In terms... I realize if somebody clearly tell you they will not obey the law, you know, you're not protected by anything, so then you start to think, do you still want to play the game? Yeah, it does change me somehow. But as I told them clearly, even they have to take me out or put a bullet in me, I still cannot be changed in my belief. So they also understand. So at the same moment, I also change them. They understand who I am, and they understand what kind of tactics will not work on me.
Yeah, what a brave man. Just, what do you say, just one clown, a funny artist who cares? The artist Ai Weiwei, in conversation with Virginia Trioli from ABC Television Breakfast at the National Gallery of Victoria, opening that exhibition of his work. Well, it opens tomorrow night, actually, at the National Gallery. It runs right through until late April next year. And keep an ear out on RN's Big Ideas early next year, because we're going to broadcast the whole of that interview on Big Ideas. It's a very, very engaging conversation. And if you can't wait until then, if you go onto YouTube, you'll find it all there. Just Google it now. You'll find it on YouTube. It's a marvellous conversation. Virginia did a lovely job. In fact, the two of them are just marvellous together. It's like meta-transformation music. Anna Frey Taylor is kind of composing herself, assembling her molecules right in front of me here in the studio, because it's time for Art News. Hello.
Hello, Michael.
Welcome to the studio. Before we talk about your Art News, we've got some news from Leela Schooner, who's a sound engineer here at RN, who was listening to our segment before Ai Weiwei, when we were talking about music, about umpah music, and apparently heute blau, morgen blau, doesn't mean we're depressed, it means we're drunk. In German, blau, blue, means that you're absolutely smashed. So today smashed, tomorrow smashed, which explains the tone of that song we were playing. Anyway, Ai Weiwei, he's in the news.
Well, yes, he's in town, but other things are happening. He's not making news for all the usual reasons this week. In England, the Turner Prize has been announced this week, Michael. So this is the UK's most prestigious art prize. Takes its name from JMW Turner, but it is not a painting prize. Artists can be working in any media.
It can be painting.
It can be painting.
But anything.
Anything. Often, you know, it's been won by sculptors before, installation artists. But this year, Michael, it has been won by an 18-member collective of architects.
A team.
A team, yeah. So this group of architects go by the name Assemble. They don't actually consider themselves artists, which is very interesting. The work that they do is a kind of combination of art, design and architecture.
But do they make houses people actually live in?
Well, I think that people might live in them. They've been nominated for a project called the Granby 4 Streets Project, which is an urban regeneration project. It's taking place in Liverpool. They've been working on it for the last few years. And what they did is they renovated a whole street of run-down terraced houses, which were due to be demolished. They were working with the local residents. I'm not sure if people are living with them, but they're doing social projects there, so yeah. Training programs, education programs.
Well, the houses are for sale, aren't they? So I think that's how it's going to work.
No, I don't think they're for sale. They were going to be demolished.
Oh, I see.
I think that they're sort of council houses. But so they've regenerated them.
Oh, I see.
They've got all these projects happening. They did a mock-up for the Turner Prize exhibition. And inside this kind of mock-up fake house, they had all of these home furnishings, ceramic tiles, textiles, door handles, all the things that people engaged in the projects in Liverpool have been creating. The idea being that they'll sell these kind of artefacts and then use the money to keep going with their
regeneration. Oh, that's what they're selling.
Project.
They're selling their artifacts. I misread it. They're not selling the houses, Michael.
Not the houses.
Nong?
No, the artifacts.
The artifacts.
Anyway, so this is pretty different work, Michael, for the Turner Prize this year. I mean, we've come to associate the Turner Prize with lots of sort of inward-looking art. You might remember Damien Hirst's infamous shark in formaldehyde. That actually didn't win the Turner Prize that year, but that was part of the exhibition in 1990.
No, I associate it with controversy, or some people say controversy.
Yep, that's right. In 2001, there was a bit of controversy over the Martin Krieg work. So he had an installation called Work Number 227, The Lights Going On and Off. This was just a work comprised entirely of an exhibition space. Every now and again, the lights would just go
empty
on.
Empty room with some lights going on.
So
off.
Very different stuff from the Turner Prize.
Tracy Emin's the big famous.
Tracy Emin, yeah.
Her bed.
Her rumpled bed sheets, yep. But there seems to have appealed to the judges for that very reason, Michael, that it's a bit different. They praise the project for its ground-up approach to regeneration, city planning and development in opposition to corporate gentrification. And they said that it draws on the long tradition of artistic and collective initiatives that experiment in art, design and architecture. And in doing so, they offer alternative models to how societies can work. And their work shows the importance of artistic practice being able to drive and shape urgent issues.
So all of us. Yep. And is there any controversy about this? What's the art world making of
this? No, people are happy.
They love it. Of course they do.
People seem to be very thrilled. So they don't seem to be concerned that they're calling themselves architects and not artists. So yesterday your guest Grayson Perry was on the show. He's a nice man. He won the Turner Prize back in 2003. So I asked him what he thought of the win and also whether he sees any distinction between architecture and art. And this is what he said.
I was delighted, actually, that Assemble won because they were my favourites. I mean, when I read the list of nominees for the Turner Prize these days, I don't know who they are. I feel very old. But Assemble I had read a bit about, and they really appealed to me because I think they're really where art is at the moment, you know, sort of socially engaged, not necessarily part of the kind of huge money market. They don't even describe themselves, I don't think, necessarily. It's like fine artists. So they're very interesting. But there's a lot of people around the world now doing that kind of art, you know, where it's sort of... Because I think what happened was that art in the 20th century kind of exploded as what it could be. Now we're seeing the fallout of that. It's all sort of settling across our society and art is being kind of integrated into all parts of the world. So these people are, you know, helping do up and regenerate areas in Manchester in interesting and imaginative ways with a humour and a lightness of touch. You know, ever since Duchamp brought the urinal into the exhibition, you know, I think the game is over. You know, if you can justify it and everybody agrees with you, then it's art. Get on with it.
Did you grab him just after I spoke to him yesterday?
I did.
You waylaid him with a tape recorder. Well done.
Anyway, so that's what Grayson says. Get on with it. That's what the Assemble guys are doing, so good on them.
Meanwhile, in Russia.
In Russia. Michael, as we speak right now in Russia, a four-day marathon, public reading of Leo Tolstoy's War and Peace is underway. So this reading is being coordinated by Tolstoy's great-great-granddaughter, Fekla Tolstoya. And from what I gather, it's a kind of reading relay. So 1,300 readers are taking part across more than 30 cities. They're each going to read 2 or 3 minutes of the book before the next person takes over and reads a section. They're going to read for 4 days.
But no one gets to hear it all. They're in 30 different cities.
Well, you can hear it all. It's being live streamed on the internet.
Oh, it's online.
And also on Russian state television channel Kultura. So it started on Tuesday morning. We're presuming it finishes on Friday evening. It's happening right now. Michael, if you go to the website, there's a link on our homepage. This is what you will hear.
А чтобы к нему их не пускали. Княжна Мария решилась принять Ростовых, но всякую минуту боялась, как бы князь не сделал какую-нибудь выходку.
And on and on it goes for days and days and days and days.
That's War and Peace in Russian.
Great, good.
Yeah.
I don't know. It doesn't sound that entertaining as an idea.
But, I think it's fantastic.
Extremely briefly, because we're almost out of time, but Tropfest, good news.
Tropfest is back, yes. So you'll recall last month it was announced that the festival was going to be cancelled.
This is the short film festival in Sydney.
They'd had what John Paulson described as a terrible and irresponsible mismanagement of funds.
He's the guy that runs it.
But CGU Insurance Company has come to their rescue. They're giving them the funds for the festival to go ahead next year. So it will be taking place once more in February.
Hooray!
In the Centennial Park in Sydney. So good news for Tropfest.
Good on you, Anna.
Thank you, Michael.
Anna Frey-Taylor, who brings us arts news from time to time, looks after all the books too. You should see her desk. We should tweet your desk. Let's do that. Let's tweet the photo of your desk so Australia can see just how hard you work. How chaotic. No, it's not chaotic. It's all very orderly. And you look after me so well. It's only because of Anna that I know what I'm supposed to be reading next. She keeps me honest. Talking of honest, according to Anna, I have to read Salman Rushdie's prize-winning book, Midnight's Children, because that's our final book club book that's coming up today, week. Almost upon us, so we need to get that read. And I'm about to hop on a plane to go to Canberra because there are two big exhibitions on there. One's at the National Portrait Gallery called Sideshow Alley, and the other is a huge exhibition of the work of Tom Roberts at the National Gallery. So I'll be talking to you tomorrow from Canberra. Earshot's next. I'm Michael Cathcart. This is RN. Toodaloo.